So we're looking, as we have been for a few weeks now, at the seed that would germinate and come to flower as the great vehicle, the Mahayana. And we're looking at the seed as it expresses in this earliest, what's probably the earliest known text of the perfection of wisdom tradition, known as the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. Perfection is paramita, and wisdom is pranya. Pra is full or absolute, and nya is knowledge. So pranya, wisdom. The Pali, this is the Sanskrit now, the Pali is panya. So pranya paramita is the perfection of wisdom. And very early in this tradition, it's understood in a very interesting parallel to the Greek Sophia and other traditions throughout broader Asia and Europe, that wisdom might be best understood in a feminine form or visualized in a feminine form. And some scholars think that prajna paramita is a Buddhist version of Saraswati, the Hindu counterpart, who is the goddess of wisdom in that tradition, and who rides a swan in the Hindu tradition, and is also the goddess of music. So paramita is more often depicted in the Buddhist world deep in meditation. So she's listening to the music of the spheres. Which I think is the same thing as playing it. And she has this quality then of being the perfection or quality that enfolds all the other qualities. Right? The list of perfections that begins with dana, the perfection of giving, and unfolds through the perfection of wise relationship or sila, the ethical perfections, and the perfections of renunciation, nekamma, letting go, and all the rest. There's 10 in the Pali tradition. There's 6 in the Sanskrit Mahayana tradition, but the lists overlap. And prajna paramita is considered the foremost. And in this text, prajna paramita is said to be the foremost because wisdom is the quality that holds all the others, right? And you might think about this in the same way that in the early teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path, that the limb of right view holds all the others, or is the foundation for all the others, right? Without clarity around how we see the world or understand our place in the world, all of our other disciplines and cultivations fall short. You know, or are too limited, you might say. And we've talked about this a bit already with the that part early in the perfection of wisdom that says, you know, if a faithful practitioner were to gather up enormous cosmic amounts of precious gems and precious substances and build stupas to honor Buddhas, to honor the Blessed One, and, you know, build temples and fill the universe with, you know, offerings. Essentially, if someone cultivated the perfection of dana, of giving, in this enormous way, spreading enormous amounts of wealth around, and, you know, for social uplift and worship and all the rest, how much blessing or merit would that generate? And you know, the answer, of course, is like great, in immeasurable merit, you know, that would generate. And the Buddha says, yes, it would. But even greater than that is the merit of one person who takes one stanza of this perfection of wisdom and copies it down and memorizes it and repeats it to others, gives it away to others. And that's not meant to denigrate relative world practice. It's not meant to say like, oh, well, therefore you shouldn't be generous with your wealth. You know, you shouldn't worship in a kind of straightforward way the Buddhas or anything. It's a way of saying that without wisdom, the entire tradition can't exist. That wisdom, because wisdom is the thing that makes Buddhas, Buddhas, right? Ones who are awake. They are awake because they have understood with profound clarity the nature of this existence. Wisdom creates Buddhas. Therefore, all of the disciplines and practices undertaken by those engaged in the path are supported by, undergirded by, shot through with, and meaningless without wisdom, right? This is why there can be such a thing as wrong, not just wrong view, but there can be wrong ethics, wrong mindfulness, right? There's wrong mindfulness. If there can be right mindfulness, mindfulness in service of the path to liberation, there can be wrong mindfulness. Mindfulness not in service of the path to liberation. There can be wrong concentration, right? Famous story of the Himalayan saint who wasn't a saint at the beginning of his practice, Jetsun Milarepa, who out of anger at his village being destroyed and his family traumatized by a neighboring sorcerer, he studied the dark arts and became a sorcerer himself, who through concentration was able to call down hail upon the village of his enemies and destroy them and kill people and livestock and destroy the fields. And only after realizing that this was not a path to anything but hell, he wakes up to the path and finds a teacher, Marpa, who guides him in an arduous training to work through the karma that he had developed by letting his heart become so lost in hatred that he could bring harm upon other beings in this way. He had developed wrong concentration, wrong effort, wrong view. And he was able to turn that around. So this is true for all the path factors. They can be moving toward wisdom and clarity and peace, and they can be moving toward unclarity and violence. And so, without wisdom, there's no path. And so then prajna paramita becomes not just the quality that gives rise to Buddhas, but becomes the mother of all Buddhas, the one who gives birth to Buddhas. Buddhas are born from wisdom. And so this comparison, oh, the one who gives all these, you know, builds all the temples and gives all this resources is, you know, doesn't generate as much merit as one who, you know, recites one stanza of this perfection of wisdom to others. It's a way of saying that without wisdom becoming perfected, becoming into its fullness, all of the other disciplines of the path will fall short. At the heart of this new turning, and we'll get on at some point to talking about the turnings of the wheel, but this is a new turn in the development of the Buddha's teachings that comes out in this body of literature. The authors of this literature understand that it's a bit radical, and so they put in the position of the kind of straw man the early Buddhist monk known as the Marshal of the Dhamma, Venerable Sariputta. Here it's in the Sanskrit version, Shariputra. And And initially in the text, he's the one who asks the kind of innocent old-fashioned questions. Wait, but what about practice? What about development? What about things actually meaning things? And the answer, like we talked about a few weeks ago, is that in this understanding of the perfection of wisdom, language implodes into deconstruction before you even finish saying it. There's no such thing as a dharma to be attained. There's no one who practices, and there's no one who is liberated. And this blows Shariputra's mind. He's us in this situation, right? We're like, what about my purification process? What about my healing? You know, Shariputra's the one who says, what about healing? What about concentration? And the answer is always something like, who's concentrating? On what? Who's healing from what? What has ever gotten you bound that you need to be healed from? And it takes several chapters, but by the middle of the text, Shariputra is the one now saying this. He learns fast. This perfection of wisdom is the ultimate. This is the thing to be praised. You know, he's on board, as we should be. That's the implication, right? But along with this conversion of Shariputra, and it is a conversion, is the proposal that the one who practices the perfection of wisdom is a different kind of practitioner than the early practitioners, the ones who were seeking the liberation of the individual heart from suffering and from rebirth, the ones who would come to be known as the perfected ones or the arahants. He said those people attain a kind of liberation from suffering, but they don't go far enough into understanding the absolute nature that the perfection of wisdom points toward. The one who goes all the way is a fully awakened Buddha. And the ones on the path to becoming a fully awakened Buddha are known as bodhisattvas. Bodhi is awakening. It's the same root as the word Buddha, which means awake, but it also means intelligence in Pali and Sanskrit. And sattva is being. So bodhisattvas are beings dedicated to awakening. What makes a being a seeker on the path, known as one who hears the teachings, a shravaka in the Mahayana tradition, and what makes one a bodhisattva? So we've heard a couple of definitions so far of what makes a being a bodhisattva. One of the first given in the text is that a bodhisattva is someone who hears the teachings on emptiness, on the radical emptiness of all conceptual forms, and is not afraid. Bodhisattvas are fearless. And they're fearless particularly when confronted with the teaching that they don't really exist, nor does anyone else, nor does anything anywhere. And exist here doesn't mean isn't real, but sort of does. But it really means doesn't exist as a separate, isolated, distinct, permanent entity, right? And so then the positivistic correlation is interdependence and, you know, interconnection. To say everything is interconnected is the same as saying that everything is empty. So, you know, live on whichever side of that, you know, positive or negative divide you prefer. They are the same. The insight is that the thing that we think we are, which is a separate individual with my hopes, my dreams, my qualities, my faults, and my distinct relationship with the world, that is an indefensible existential fiction. That we can't actually find the boundary between ourselves and others, right? It's conventionally obvious that I'm me and you're you and everyone has their own story and everyone's a marvelous, unique snowflake. I don't know how they turn snowflake into an insult. Snowflakes are some of the most extraordinarily beautiful things ever. And yes, they're all slightly different from each other and they are all just ice fractals. And it's sort of funny to emphasize their uniqueness because mostly how we see them is in enormous fluffy masses. But so, you know, so we all are beautiful, unique snowflakes, and And we're all, you know, shimmering hexagonal fractals of the same thing, of the same stuff. And this is core all the way back to the early tradition, right? One of the earliest meditations in the Buddhist system is to think about the qualities of the great elements, right? Of the solidity of earth and the cohesiveness and flow of water and the heat or temperature of fire and the mobility of wind, the movement quality of wind, and the extensiveness quality of space, and to recognize that everything we think we are is composed of those things, and everything else is also composed of those things. So if you say, where's the earth element in myself? And you get all the way out to the edge of your skin, if you're really sensitive, what you'll find, first of all, is that the skin is not as solid as you think, and that when you perceive your arm, you end up perceiving a field of scintillating, tiny, shimmery points. And if you extend your attention out past the arm, it's just more shimmery points going out and out and out. So these are meditative states. And the Mahayana is based in a set of very deep, unbounded meditative states. And so you understand that everything is composed of earth. And everything has a kind of solidity to it in various ways. Everything has a kind of cohesiveness to it, which is the primary quality of water. Everything has a temperature, and everything moves, which is wind. And you say, oh, the whole universe is composed of these great elements, and so am I. And of course, the punchline is, that means that this thing that I'm so constricted around, the precious uniqueness of my bodily experience, is actually just a shape that has coalesced temporarily out of the shimmering everythingness of the universe. And with that coalesced temporary form has come a coalesced temporary consciousness that recognizes this and says, this is me, this is mine, right? When something hits me, it hurts. That feels like me. When something is kind to me, my body, that feels good and that feels like me. And I want more of the good and less of the hurt. And that's how I know that I'm here and you're there. And all of that is real enough, right? And we don't want to fall into the bypass that says, oh, none of that is real, therefore it doesn't matter what we do to each other. It completely matters. Impact matters. And impact doesn't matter individually in the way that we think it does, because everything impacts everything else. And so the place the Mahayana goes with this conception of the Bodhisattva is that the Bodhisattva is the one who's not afraid of this teaching and therefore is able to enter into meditative states that are, and this is the phrasing used in the Heart Sutra, that are like removing the walls from the mind. And the walls here are all of the concepts, both big, sort of gross, obvious concepts, you know, like self and other, or racial distinctions, or national distinctions, or political distinctions, you know, it is the season. Things that we think define, you know, this versus that. The Bodhisattva is able to enter meditations where all of those dissolve. And these are super mystical states, but they're also very ordinarily accessible states of meditation. They are there as soon as you don't believe a story that arises in the mind. And as soon as you don't look at your own body through the lens of possession and identity. And these are not that far away, right? A little bit of relaxing and getting quiet, feeling safe, feeling non-threatened, being calm but also energized and awake. You can touch this just by setting down the obsession with, you know, myself, my drama, my story. And so early in the text, it's going to say, oh, bodhisattvas, they liberate all beings. But they do this by recognizing that there's no such thing as beings to be liberated. Okay, so how, but how do you do that? You know, do you just try to forget the uniqueness of individuals? That doesn't work, right? I never forget that we are separate individuals, right? I don't think it's possible, or certainly not, it's not easy to go in a kind of step-by-step gradual way from, you know, individualistic psychology to infinite, you know, boundaryless compassion. I think it's actually easier to jump there, right? To actually use bypass skillfully. And it goes something like this. I'm not going to try to convince myself, I'm not going to look at one of you and convince myself that you and I are not different. I don't think that's useful. I'm not actually sure it's even ethical in real relationship to do that. You know, certainly don't do it with your kid or your lover or your presidential candidate, you know, well, like whatever, don't do it with your enemy. Like, don't get confused about real human relationships. I don't think that's what bodhisattvas are doing. I think what bodhisattvas do is they invoke the wisdom that is absolute. They invoke prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom, not the gradual growth of wisdom that I think is like the path of the seeker. They invoke the understanding that the entire universe of beings can be felt, can be conceptualized, but it's really felt as an infinitely vast, unbounded, scintillating mass, which is too limiting still, but a scintillating suchness, I'll start to use Mahayana language here, of awakeness, of consciousness, of sentience. Say, oh, there are sentient beings. There's a kind of knowing quality in the universe. And it manifests in humans, it manifests in animals, it manifests in plants, it manifests throughout the manifest world. And the Mahayana gets this. It's like, yeah, and in Buddha worlds, in cosmic fields, in distant universes, there are beings. And then it goes further and it says, oh, past and future, you silly little limited linear being. The bodhisattva collapses past and future and all of space-time into a single moment's radical openness without walls of the mind. And so this thing where bodhisattvas liberate all beings, or bodhisattvas realize that there's no beings to be liberated, you know, bodhisattvas do something that is more extraordinary than building stupas honoring cosmic Buddhas that fill all of space. How is this possible? It's because there are meditations, there are moments of clear seeing that can show to the heart that's available for it and not afraid that everything shines with a particular kind of perfection, including everything that's wrong, right? Including all the things you want to work to change. I think it's a miss for contemporary Dharma-oriented social justice seekers to think about bodhisattva action in terms of like relative social engagement and, you know, like bodhisattvas are like spiritual social workers. This is a common critique, so don't get mad at me for initiating it. Lots of people have said this. But I think it's not bad. Social action is marvelous. I think it's just way too small, because that's not actually what bodhisattvas do, as far as I can tell in the texts. What bodhisattvas do, if do is even the right word for this, is they orient themselves toward vastness of both time and space in a way that allows them to, or gives them the experiences that allow them to, remember something other than the immersion of in narratives and stories and drama that we live in. This is going to eventually start to be called the two truths, the relative and absolute, and that they interpenetrate absolutely. It's going to come out in the Heart Sutra as form and emptiness, not being separate at all. But in the earliest layer here, what we have actually is just a profound meditation. And it's a meditation on vastness. So just a couple of lines here to wrap us up, and then I'll, for the moment, and then we'll discuss this a little bit. We are sort of meanderingly proceeding in a linear way through the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, if you're following along. I'm getting toward something like chapter 10 here. And chapter 9 ends so I almost want to put it into song. It ends with the Bodhisattva Subhuti going on a long, slam poem about the perfection of wisdom. I'll read you just the beginning of it. It's 2 pages long. Subhuti, this is chapter 9, section 4. This is a perfection of what is not, because space is not something that is. This is a perfection which equals the unequaled, because all dharmas are not apprehended. This is an isolated perfection on account of absolute emptiness. I don't love that translation. This perfection cannot be crushed because all dharmas are not apprehended. This is a trackless perfection because both body and mind are absent. This is a perfection which has no own being, that's svabhava, because it neither comes nor goes. This perfection is inexpressible because all dharmas are not discriminated. This perfection is nameless because the skandhas are not apprehended, that's the 5 aggregates. This perfection does not go away because no dharma ever goes away. One cannot partake of this perfection because no dharma can be seized. This perfection is inexhaustible as linked to the inexhaustible dharma. This perfection has had no genesis because no dharma has really come about. This is a perfection which does nothing because no doer can be apprehended. This perfection does not generate anything because all dharmas are without self. It goes on and on and on and on like that, ending with, this is a perfection of the 10 powers because it cannot be crushed. This is a perfection of the 4 grounds of self-confidence because absolutely it cannot be cowed, etc., etc. This is a perfection of all the special Buddha dharmas because they have transcended all counting. This is a perfection of the suchness of the Tathagata because there is no falseness in all dharmas. This is a perfection of the self-existent because all dharmas have no own being, svabhava. This perfection of wisdom is a perfection of the cognition of the all-knowing because it comprehends all the modes of the own being of all dharmas. Okay, I don't think I can even go on into chapter 10 in the next minute, but we'll do chapter 10 a little bit next week. Chapter 10 starts to point toward how we might conceptualize ourselves as being in relation to the vastness of space-time and the vastness then of the path of the Bodhisattva, how long we must have been practicing this to be practicing it now, what it means to be connected to it and connected to the lineage of the Buddhas. So I'm going to put a bookmark in it actually now, and we'll just pick this right up next week, talking about the way that bodhisattvas now are supposed to get a prediction toward becoming a Buddha in a future, in some distant future, eon, in the presence of a Buddha. So now all bodhisattvas have this moment in the presence of a Buddha where they get recognized as having the potential to become a Buddha themselves. And this becomes the thing that you either have already gotten or are seeking to get, which is contact with a Buddha somewhere in space-time where you can receive the prediction that kind of blasts you out of this moment in time and space into the timelessness of the Bodhisattva path, and the promise then of eventual arising as a fully awakened Buddha. All of this is only possible because space and time are radically empty and ungraspable. So we'll continue in that way.